In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about the Cultural Revolution. This was a watershed period in modern Chinese history, a time between 1966 and 1976. The immediate result of the Cultural Revolution was chaos and killing and stagnation. But it also provoked an era of reform in which capitalism has flourished and the party has lost much of its former authority. In this first hour of the program, we'll be talking about the Cultural Revolution with Roderick McFarker. He is professor of history and political science and professor of government at Harvard University, and is the co-author of a book that examines in great detail the Cultural Revolution, what happened in China during those years, and also tries to explain why it happened. The book is Mao's Last Revolution, and it is published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. It's out there in the bookstores now, certainly. It has been for a little while, and if you're interested in reading on the Cultural Revolution, you should look for the book. Also, here this morning on the program, as always, we welcome questions from people who are listening. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. So, at any point, questions are welcome. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people are brief, and we ask that so we can keep moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to call. Professor McFarker, hello.
Hi.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
I'm very grateful to you for giving us another chance to publicize our book.
To begin, in brief, what was the Cultural Revolution?
It was an attempt by Mao Zedong, Chairman Mao, as he was known, the leader of China, to re-revolutionize the country and, in particular, the Communist Party, which he felt had become slack and lost its direction. And he was prepared to sacrifice all the old comrades, if necessary, in order to introduce a new group of younger, more revolutionary party members who would follow his ideas.
Mm-hmm. And the result of all of this, we can talk about this in greater detail, but particularly for people who aren't familiar with this history, during this 10-year period, particularly the earlier part of that period, there was an enormous amount of disruption and destruction that was associated with the revolution, particularly the activities of the Red Guards, who were essentially simply turned loose.
Yes, Mao felt that the way to get the country to be revolutionary again was essentially one of training a new generation of successors. And in order to give those potential successors, first of all high school students and then university students, as it turned out, the chance to be revolutionary in a non-revolutionary period, he unleashed them to attack what he called the headquarters, to bombard the headquarters, which, of course, were the local and national leaders in the various party and governmental offices. And he felt that though these people had not partaken in the famous epic long march of the Communist Party, nor the civil war against the Nationalist Party, nevertheless, this experience would give them the chance to be revolutionary. Mm. So he unleashed them against the party and the state.
He seemed to believe that that this kind of ferment, some people would say chaos, was necessary to maintain the kind of revolutionary muscle tone of the country, in a sense. It seemed that he was it that he was distrustful of stability?
I think that he himself once said that he loved Luan. He loved upheaval. He loved the whole business of struggle rather than routinized conduct of the economy and the country. And the other factor in this is that when a country becomes routinized, when the revolution is over and you have to run a country, then you have a different agenda, an agenda which has to do with economic development and getting all the parts of the economy in sync and so on. And Mao knew that that kind of running of a country was not his forte. That was, if that was the way China was to develop, he would be surplus to requirements, and he was not about to give up his control of the agenda. An agenda for him meant revolution, struggle, and that's what he unleashed in 66.
I think that I expect that if one asks this question, who ultimately was responsible for starting and for directing the Cultural Revolution, one might get a different answer depending on who you ask. And certainly in China, Mao's responsibility has been acknowledged, but a lot of the blame for the destruction has been laid at the feet of others, particularly Mao's wife, Zhang Cheng, and the circle of associates known as the Gang of Four. It seems that one of the things, though, that you want to try to make clear is that Mao Zedong himself started the Cultural Revolution, and at least in the early years before he became incapacitated by health problems, that in fact he was really the person who was directing it. So one would have to say, in very large part, the person perhaps most responsible for the Cultural Revolution was Mao himself.
That's certainly my opinion. More importantly, it's the opinion of the Communist Party of China as well in their discussion, which they issued as a document after the end of the Cultural Revolution. Mao was the person who originated. But it would be wrong to think of him as being its director until he was incapacitated in the mid-70s as he got more and more sick. Because the whole essence of the Cultural Revolution was that the Red Guards, the youth, the people generally should make revolution for themselves. And what Mao was trying to get away from was precisely that the Communist Party's normal operating procedure, which was to make sure that everything was under their control. If it was under Mao's control, then there was no revolution being made. So once he unleashed the Red Guards, they were deliberately allowed to do what they felt was necessary for the revolution as they interpreted Mao's words. The reason why, therefore, it's possible for the party after the Cultural Revolution to blame Madame Mao and the so-called Gang of Four and others is precisely because though they were actually more responsive to Mao, on whom their power depended, nevertheless, they also took independent action. And since the Cultural Revolution was about independent revolutionary action, it was possible for the party to blame a lot of the mayhem on the Gang of Four, on Madame Mao.
Did he anticipate the extent to which there would be chaos and destruction? Was there at any point, as far as we know from whatever records have been left or what people have said, any point where he voiced misgivings, concern, regrets that he had opened this up?
I don't think he was ever in the business of expressing regrets. What did happen prior to the dissolution, in effect, of the Red Guards and scattering of them to factories and fields across the country in 1968 on, what happened was that when the Red Guards had disposed of the governmental and party leaders in various parts of the country, they then fought among themselves. There was enormous factional fighting, and a lot of the violence in the cities of China after mid-1967 was, in fact, Red Guards fighting each other to see who would be the new bosses of that village, town, or even province. And what happened in 68 is that Mao could see that there was a real danger, that people were so upset, so unhappy with the chaos in the cities especially, that the army might act unilaterally without his command to suppress the Red Guards. And so instead of allowing that to happen, he called in the Red Guard leaders of Beijing, an incredible meeting late at night in the home of the Chinese party leadership, and surrounded by all his military and party colleagues who had survived so far, he said, "You've let me down." In other words, instead of uniting together to form new leaderships under his guidance, they had fallen to fighting, and he blamed them for that. Whereas, of course, he should have known from his knowledge of China that that was almost inevitable.
Mm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Roderick McFarker. He's professor of history and political science and professor of government at Harvard University. He's the co-author of the book Mao's Last Revolution, published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. It is a history of the Cultural Revolution in China, this 10-year period between 1966 and 1976. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You talked about the fact that Mao genuinely believed that this kind of revolutionary ferment would be good for the country, or at least he's someone who thought that chaos, upheaval was healthy, that perhaps that was his, he saw that as his natural element and perhaps was distrustful of peace and stability. Having said all that, to what extent was this also, was the Cultural Revolution also intended to, by Mao, to get rid of his political enemies, his opponents, and to allow him to maintain his position of political power?
Well, that was a common supposition among some analysts of Chinese events, especially during the Cultural Revolution. But in fact, if you look at the way that the Cultural Revolution developed, if that had been his objective, he could have stopped the Cultural Revolution somewhere around about January, February 1967, within a year of it starting, because by that time, his principal colleagues, in particular the head of state, who had been the number two in the party, his principal colleagues were already on the dustbin of history. So they were out. He was in charge. He always had been in charge. The idea that he wasn't, that is a fiction. He was very much in charge, and he could have stopped the Cultural Revolution right there if he had not wanted to revolutionize the young people of China.
Also, to what extent did this have to do with some tensions between China and the Soviet Union, between Mao and Nikita Khrushchev, and perhaps tensions that went to what Mao saw as an abandonment of essential principles by the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, and Mao's interest in trying to make sure that those kinds of principles, basic Marxism-Leninism, continued to be at the heart of politics in China.
I think you're absolutely right to emphasize this point, because there's no question, if you look at the record over the early 60s, that Mao got more and more angry and uncertain about the course that the Soviet Union, first under Khrushchev and then under his successor Brezhnev, was taking. And it was precisely in a open attack on the Soviet Union and its party in 1964 that he laid out what turned out to be, I doubt if his colleagues knew this at the time, no one knew it, only himself, turned out to be the justification for the Cultural Revolution, because he argued the Soviet Union was being turned into a capitalist nation. The leaders of the Soviet Communist Party had deserted the path of true Leninism and were reestablishing pre-communist capitalist organizations. He was, of course, about 20 years out of date, but that was his fear. And so I think that the quarrel with the Soviet Union, particularly over foreign policy towards the United States, was a key element in Mao's decision to launch the Cultural Revolution. He did not want his colleagues to end up like Khrushchev and Brezhnev did after the death of Stalin.
Let's talk with a caller here. We have someone who'd like to join in here in Urbana, where we are. This is line number one.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, just not that long ago, there was something about some 100 million pigs getting some virus in China, and they had to slaughter them or something. But what amazed me was that there was no giant pig farms like we have in this country. They said it was like, you know, two pig family units. So I guess what I'm wondering is, then and now, how much were these kind of units affected by whatever the central government was?
Well, effectively, during the Cultural Revolution, there was no effective central government. That was part of Mao's plan, to throw everything in the air and see what happened. The result was that there was chaos not merely in the cities, which is what we originally saw, because that was where foreigners mainly were based in China at the time, but also in the countryside. And the result was that people couldn't get the peasants to do things any more than they can now. If you don't have in China, with very few exceptions, the kind of great farms and estates that you have in the United States. So each peasant was allowed, after his farm and everyone else's had been collectivized, was allowed to keep as his private property maybe a couple of pigs to sell in the market or to have pork on special occasions. But you don't have the great farm that you have in the United States. The countryside is not really configured that way.
Certainly the Cultural Revolution affected people who were involved in politics, people who were in government at all levels, national and local and in the big cities. It involved intellectuals. It involved university students and professors. To what extent did the Cultural Revolution touch the life of the more average Chinese person, and did it?
It touched the average Chinese. The Chinese Communist Party, in its post-Mao summary of the Cultural Revolution, said it touched about 100 million Chinese. That means directly affected their families. But I think that the Cultural Revolution actually affected, if not everyone in China, a high proportion. Certainly in the cities, whether big cities or small towns, there would be Red Guards looking for their place in the Maoist sun, and they would be active, and they would be attacking those people who they saw as representatives of the old bourgeoisie or the new bourgeoisie, the party, the local party leaders. And this would happen also in the countryside. People in China jump onto bandwagons, or they used to jump onto bandwagons very quickly in those days when they saw the way that things were going. And some of my colleagues have argued that one of the reasons for the violence in the post-Red Guard period, when there was considerable violence run by local authorities, was precisely because these new local authorities did not know how to run their area, but the one thing they did know was that if they weren't revolutionary enough, they'd be out. Mm-hmm. And they thought that being revolutionary meant killing, and that could be the countryside or it could be the cities.
And then one could see how chaos would escalate as people tried to be more revolutionary than the next guy.
That's right. And then of course, the military effectively took over. In the second half of the period that's called the Cultural Revolution, the military was effectively running China because the party and the government structures had been so dismantled.
And at that point, then the Red Guards were sidelined. Essentially, it was viewed that they had caused so much trouble that the decision was made basically to get rid of them in a sense. And that was this period when so many of them were then dispersed out to do political work and what would have been called political work in the countryside to get in touch with the lives of the masses.
I think political work would be glorifying it. these kids thought they were going to inherit the earth, and they ended up tilling it. And they often had very hard lives. Immediately at the end of the Cultural Revolution, after Mao had died, there was a one-chance examination for all those city kids who had been dispersed. A one-time examination to allow people to get into college. And many made it, but a greater number, I'm sure, didn't make it and remained in the countryside.
How were the Red Guards created? How did that come about?
Well, we have an exact account of that. There were some kids. They really were kids because they were at an elite high school in Beijing. And they got together sometime in the late spring of 1966. And they said, Chairman Mao's fort is under attack. We have to defend it. And they then said, well, if we're going to defend it, we should have a name. And they ran several possible titles up the flagpole. And the one that that little group saluted was Red Guards. And the next thing they did was to put up a poster, a big character poster, as they called, on the wall of their school. And soon the term Red Guard caught on. And the big time was when in mid-August Mao appeared in the first of eight massive rallies in Tiananmen Square in front of these new Red Guard organizations. And one of the Red Guard leaders was allowed to pin a Red Guard armband on his uniform. And that gave the signal to young people all over China that he had sanctified the Red Guards. And from then on, everyone was being a Red Guard. And you did it with your friends, and this is how factionalism developed. Hmm. You either allowed people to join your group, and if you didn't, well, they'd form another group.
So this was not something that that Mao or the government created. It was something that sprang up, in a sense, and then was taken advantage of. Mao no doubt saw this as being a tool, and something that he could use, and once he gave it his sanction, then it really took off.
That's exactly right. Of course, Mao had plenty of evidence from the mid-1950s, when there was a brief liberal period, that the students of China were very ready to rise up, organize in the name of a cause which they believed in. And so he was well aware that if he attacked, as he got his subordinates to do, if he attacked the leading authorities of universities and said they were no longer revolutionary, then that would immediately give the hint to college students and to high school students that they were fair game. Hmm. And he knew from this experience in the mid-50s that they would be very quick to organize, and indeed they were.
And at the same time, it seems that he was in the direction that he gave to the Red Guards was rather vague, and that's so people had to spend a lot of time thinking or asking each other or talking about, well, what is it that we're expected to do here? And the direction that they got back was very, very nonspecific.
It was, but it was really critical. Mm-hmm. He had two slogans which the Red Guards immediately adopted and which he publicized in the late summer of 1966, right at the beginning of the Cultural Revolution. One was the one I mentioned already, bombard the headquarters, mm-hmm. and your headquarters was whatever the head of whatever unit you were part of. And the second was even more sort of inciting, and that was to rebel is justified. And to say to rebel is justified in a country in which up till that time the party was very much in control and didn't allow anything to happen unless it was in charge, that was really the red rag to the bulls who emerged in the Red Guard movement.
Mm. How high in the political structure was it acceptable to criticize? That is, was there some point at which people were beyond criticism? Certainly Mao would have been beyond criticism.
No one was beyond criticism. And what Mao did at the very beginning of the Cultural Revolution, and this is where we probably will never know the full details because he didn't tell anyone and he certainly didn't keep a diary. What Mao did at the beginning of the Cultural Revolution was gradually, one after the other, very carefully, never taking on the whole of the Communist Party leadership in Beijing, he sidelined one leader after another, not taking on more than one senior opponent at a time. And he did that because he knew that there were some people, like the head of state I mentioned, like the boss of Beijing, the mayor and first secretary of Beijing, and the general secretary of the party, who was Deng Xiaoping, who turned out to be eventually his successor after the Cultural Revolution was over. He knew that these people would be very difficult for 18-year-old, 19-year-old, 20-year-old kids to attack. And so he undermined them first. And once the central leadership was undermined by him, then they were fair game. After the head of state, Liu Shaoqi, was in effect thrown on the dustbin of history, it was possible for Red Guard units to come to his house and to denounce him and to rough him up a little bit. And what Mao did occasionally was to say, no, not him or not her, but very rarely.
It must have been an extraordinarily frightening time, almost no matter who you were, but certainly if you were in, someone who was in a position of some power and authority, that you would have to be always asking yourself, when will the day come when they show up on my doorstep?
Well, very quickly in the late 66 and early 67, it became clear to anyone who was politically knowledgeable at all, and that would include sort of the top and medium level leadership of the Communist Party, that everyone was fair game. Mm-hmm. And what caused a lot of the factional fighting in the provinces was that the local officials immediately tried to form their own Red Guard groups. They tried to form them out of more conservative students, out of workers who'd benefited from state policies, and other trustees they could rely on. And so what you have in many cities of China is these factional conflicts between Red Guard groups who had genuinely arisen from the masses, so to speak, and had formed themselves into an organization, against Red Guard groups who had been collected together and organized by the local authorities. And it required many directives from the center, and not always adhered to say X is the truly revolutionary Red Group, Red Guard group, and the other is a fake Red Guard group. And if the locals' fake Red Guard group was not prepared to accept that, there's nothing that the center could do about it except to eventually send in the army to suppress the fighting.
Would there have been anyone other than Mao himself, perhaps, who would have been in a position to say, to stand up and say, this, we've got to rein this in. This is not good for the country.
We make the point in our book, and it's very easy for us who never had to deal with Mao, who was a formidable personality, especially when angry. It's very easy for us to say this, but I think Chinese will say this when they are able to write freely about the Cultural Revolution in the future. And that is that you have in the persons of the head of state, Liu Shaoqi, Premier Zhou Enlai, and the various other leaders of China, including Deng Xiaoping, the general secretary, you have people of enormous revolutionary experience. You have people who are very, very tough. And the fact that they did not at any stage, and there were a number of events at which it would have been sensible for them to get together and say to Chairman Mao, look, we've always been your loyal followers, but this is madness. You cannot attack this person or you cannot do this thing because it's harmful to China, or because this person is in fact a truly revolutionary comrade who has been your faithful servant for decades. And they never came together to do that. And that was the cleverness of his way of picking off the top leaders, because each time a top leader was picked off, the next top leader who would be picked off was able to say, well, he's gone, but that gives me a stronger position to succeed the chairman, and he hasn't picked on me. But he did. And so the only person he allowed to survive, because he knew that someone had to have some kind of overall running of the country, however tenuous it was Premier Zhou Enlai, someone who he knew would never oppose him because he was not prepared to, whether it was cowardice or loyalty, take your pick. But he knew that he wouldn't oppose him, so he always protected him.
We are a little bit past our midpoint in this first hour of Focus 580, talking with Roderick McFarker. He is professor of history and political science and professor of government at Harvard University. He is the co-author of Mao's Last Revolution. It's a history of China's cultural revolution, this 10-year period between 1966 and 76, published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. It came out last summer. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller to talk with in Champaign County, line 1. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to ask you how much time or whether you spend it, and I don't expect you to agree because I'm just sort of asking it as a provocation and not necessarily because I agree with it, all right. But I don't want to be seen in any way as an apologist for all of this mayhem, but I would like for you to talk about the foreshadowing of the revolution and why what I would call, I guess, structural violence that was the land tenure system in China prior to the revolution. Do you get my drift?
Well, are you saying that this was a product of the earlier violence?
I guess that's maybe one way to put it, I suppose.
I think you make a good point. If I get you correctly, people ask, and we have to deal with this in our book. Why the violence? I mean, in a sense, what you've got with the Red Guards is what William Golding wrote about what happens when young people are given their heads without any kind of social structure around them. What we also say, however, this is in his famous novel, Lord of the Flies, but what we also say is that the young people of China, either from their parents or just by witnessing it, if they were older, had grown up with the idea of struggle and violence. The Civil War was glorified, of course. The Korean War against the United States was glorified. There was the execution of landlords. We don't know how many people were executed in the various campaigns of the early 50s when the Communist Party was asserting its control over its new state, which it was creating. But Mao admitted to something like 800,000 in one speech had been executed. Chinese I speak to have always said that that was a underestimate, perhaps deliberate, or perhaps only applying to one section of the population. But there's no question that violence, as the modus operandi of the Communist Party of China, was there as part of the inheritance of any young student of high school or college age in the mid-60s. They were well aware of this violence. And this had happened even more recently in the early 60s in something called the Socialist Transformation Campaign, when they tried to re-energize the revolutionary feelings of the peasantry. And there were lots of suicides and there's violence and so on. So, yes, the history of violence is one of the backgrounds to what happened in the Cultural Revolution. And indeed, in their summary after the Cultural Revolution was over, the Communist Party themselves admit that their long history of struggle and violence was part of the reason for what happened in the Cultural Revolution.
Well, it isn't quite what I was meaning. And I guess the question is so infrequently asked that perhaps it appears that...
Can you rephrase it?
Entirely alien. I'm talking about the structural violence that led to the revolution, basically.
You mean before the 49?
Yes, exactly. The land tenure system that was extremely abusive, extremely exploitative, to use a word that isn't.
I think what's fair to say that within the local people in the villages, the bigwigs, landlords in some cases, not necessarily, who were violent and whose death execution in the post-revolutionary period was not regretted by their fellow villagers. But what you have to remember, I think, is that the North China Plain was very, very poor soil because it had been farmed for so many centuries, indeed millennia, and that any person with real money in the countryside would not invest it in land because it wasn't worth having. They would invest it more likely in the cities. And the landlords in North China and pretty well in South China, too, were very small beer. These were not big landlords like you had in Russia or even in Eastern Europe, in Hungary, Poland, and so on. These were very small landlords. These were often in small villages. They were the grandparents or the uncles or the relatives of other villagers. And they did things like sometimes like lending out grain during times of famine and so on. So the picture is much more mixed than a simple picture as portrayed by some people who were there at the time of a rapacious landlord class who had vast territories and exploited their peasant serfs. It's nothing. It's not like that. It's more complicated than that, even admitting enormous poverty, rapes, and so on in the countryside prior to 1949. So what you ask is, why was there a revolution? And that's part of the reason why the revolution was successful, because the army was composed of peasants. The communist army was composed of peasants who had escaped from that poverty in order to try and change it. But there was a revolution also because all patriotic Chinese wanted to transform their country. And the Communist Party of China thought that that could only be done the Soviet road. And that's what they tried to copy for almost 20 years until Mao decided that the Soviet road was bankrupt and tried to have his own new revolutionary road.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. I have somebody else here, and we're moving into about our last 10 minutes, so I'd like to go on to line number two, and this is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I tuned in late, so you might have covered this. I was recently in China on a Buddhist pilgrimage, and I visited many Buddhist temples in the countryside rather than in the big cities. And what was particularly interesting to me, and I'd like to hear you talk about this, was the extent of complete destruction and devastation, both of the physical structure of temples and all that connects with that, some of which are still completely destroyed. I could see the remnants in the fields covered by the shrubs, as well as the complete destruction in terms of people who had this sort of training and history. Obviously, most of them were forced out into the to other endeavors, mining, forced labor camps, etc., etc., and the fact that China still hasn't recovered from that, at least in what I saw. Now, I'm focusing on Buddhist temples, but this goes on for all the cultural institutions and patrimony of the Chinese society, which we're talking about thousands of years of patrimony, cultural treasures, etc., destroyed. Mm-hmm. So I wondered if
yes,
you could talk about that.
And
say one last thing, and I'll stop. And the fact that Chinese, other than saying, you know, those difficult times, are still hesitant and traumatized so that they can't really speak about it.
You're absolutely right, and we haven't covered this. They are traumatized. I have quite a few Chinese students from China in my course, which I give on the Cultural Revolution. And the last time I gave it, about a year ago, many came up to me and said afterwards that they were delighted that I'd given this course because no matter how much they asked, their parents or their grandparents in some cases wouldn't talk about it. And you can see why they wouldn't talk about it. You don't want to talk about something in which you were nasty, where maybe you killed or certainly beat people up, and you wouldn't want to talk about it if you were beaten up. It's sort of shaming. So there is a sort of silence about it, and the government in China today has encouraged that because they don't want these terrible events to be researched with Mao's guilt fully pinned on him and for people to remember that it was under the Communist Party rule that this happened. To go back to the Buddhist scene, of course, the Buddhist temples and indeed all religious objects and structures were fair game during the Cultural Revolution because no party official, especially if he or she was under attack himself, was going to defend them. And so if we have some pictures in our book, in fact, of some of this religious attack on the people and the structures of religion. What is very interesting now and I'd be interested to know if you felt this, is that despite the destruction, what has happened in the post-Cultural Revolution era has been a revival, an immense revival of religion. The Falun Gong, which the communists have conducted a strong campaign against, is one example. But Buddhism, too, and Christianity. There are more Christians in China today than ever there were during the period of Western missionaries in China. And the reason is simple. Up till the end of the 19th century, people had a general belief in Confucianism as a social and political doctrine which governed their daily lives as their relationship to the government. Under Mao, in the early years, up to the Cultural Revolution, they had Marxism-Leninism. This was the doctrine which governed their personal and their social and their political lives. Now they have nothing. They are rudderless, and they know, as many as anyone else knows, that man does not live by bread alone, even though the pursuit of wealth in China has become so enormously important. And people are searching for something bigger than themselves, bigger than political pap, which is all they get these days. And so Buddhist monuments may have been destroyed, but Buddhism, I suspect, is flourishing, even if it's only in the privacy of people's homes. And certainly the Christian church, both the official churches, which are controlled by the government, and the so-called house churches, which are privately private communities of Christians, both Catholic and Protestant, these are a part of the example of the moral bankruptcy of China today, the moral vacuum that the Cultural Revolution has left behind.
I can report just from my own small experiences. I did stay at a Buddhist monastery for several days and visited many temples, that there was a vibrancy in the monastery in terms of the number of monks and lay people living there, and the fact that there was an ongoing public presence of the... In fact, it's the public used the monastery that I stayed at, which is Bai Lin Su, it doesn't make a difference where, it's in northern China, almost as a public gathering place, very much like Americans use malls. I mean, I know Chinese have malls as well, but in the sense that it was a place where people came during the week for hang out, as well as to do things like offer incense and hear talks, and that the abbot actually talked about the fact that what was most important for him, he felt, and others felt, was now making Buddhism and Buddhist practice appropriate for the everyday life issues that the Chinese people are facing in the midst of the social and economic transformations. And that's what he talked about in English. So, I mean, we were able to speak with him. The only thing he did emphasize was that there aren't enough monks, or whatever you want to call them, priests, to take care of the temples, because there's so many temples, and there's this enormous age gap in terms of training. You know, they go to a certain age, and then there's this gap of senior people. So,
fascinating. Yes, it doesn't surprise me at all.
Well, I appreciate, again, the comments of the Carl. We have about 5 minutes here. Something I want to make sure that I give you an opportunity to discuss is the way in which today's China has been shaped by the Cultural Revolution. You say very clearly early on in the book that if one is to understand China today, you must understand the Cultural Revolution. Is there, in a sense, in which you think that today's China was a response to the Cultural Revolution?
Absolutely. I think he didn't put it in these terms, but his actions speak louder than words. I think that Deng Xiaoping, who emerged as the leader of China in the late 70s, early 80s, felt very strongly that if the Communist Party didn't reform the way it ran China, they would be thrown out. After a disaster, the Great Famine of the late 50s, when maybe 40 million people died who shouldn't have died, and then the chaos and killing of the Cultural Revolution, if the Communist Party didn't shape up, then there was a real danger of it being overthrown. And so he put everything into economic development. And This was shown again when the Soviet Union collapsed. Deng Xiaoping immediately made sure that he re-energized the economic drive. Basically, he felt the Communist Party had lost 30 years, because if he looked outside China, all throughout East Asia, which was the old Chinese cultural sphere, Japan, Korea, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Taiwan, all these places had miracles. They're all economically developed. And what had the Chinese been doing? They've been tearing themselves apart and destroying the possibility of actually taking a lead in this transformation of East Asia, as indeed they now are doing. What they have done, what Deng Xiaoping has done, with all sorts of unorthodox sayings, such as to get rich is glorious, some will get rich quicker than others, he just unleashed the people to make money. And institutions were told to make money. He wasn't interested in people being able to mouth the slogans of Marxism, Leninism, or Mao Zedong thought. What he wanted was people to be able to run farms, to negotiate good deals with foreign investors, and to be able to transform Chinese state industry in profit-making enterprises so that people could have a decent standard of living. And that's what the party today is relying on. And you've got to realize that this is really not just a transformation in the Communist Party rule, which certainly is a watershed in that. It's also really a transformation in the way Chinese have been ruled throughout the centuries, because even under Confucian emperors, the state liked to control all the major sources of wealth because they saw in private wealth a threat to the state power. And no Confucian Mandarin would have said, to get rich is glorious. That would have been giving the wrong story, even though there were plenty of people who got rich from commerce in traditional China. Equally, communists have never said put wealth creation by individuals in the forefront of their agenda. But this is what Deng Xiaoping's done. So basically, he's made profit an okay word, so that for the first time in Chinese history, you have private people making profits, but making them legitimately, making them with the sanction of the state. Mm. And this is really a major turnaround in the way China is run. The problem is, how do you run this country? You've unshackled enterprise. You've allowed dynamic people to have their heads. But how do you control them when the party has lost its authority as a result of the Cultural Revolution, when there's no doctrine to make people all look to the party for leadership, and you have no longer any revolutionary leaders of great stature who might command respect? So how do you run this country? That is a problem which the Chinese Communist Party is grappling with and hasn't yet, in my view, found the right answer. Yeah.
We have perhaps just about a minute left. We have talked about the fact that in China, people still don't talk about what happened during the Cultural Revolution. It's something that they still haven't really come to grips with in a public kind of a way. Assuming that you think that the day will come when that will happen, how long do you think that'll take?
Well, I think it's not going to happen while the Communist Party of China is in charge, because one of their main legitimizing factors today, after the depredations of the Cultural Revolution, is Chairman Mao himself. And what they tried to do immediately after the Cultural Revolution was say, yes, he was wrong to launch this, but he was a great revolution. They have to say this because the whole communist conquest of power in China is associated indelibly with Mao. And so they cannot afford to let his reputation go. And so while the Communist Party of China is in charge, it will be very difficult. Some people have written books. Some people have written memoirs. But it will be very difficult to get objective, factual histories of the Cultural Revolution without a layer of excusing of Chairman Mao. So it will take till there's no longer a Communist Party running China.
There we will have to leave it. Our guest, Roderick McFarker, is professor of history and political science and professor of government at Harvard University. He is the co-author of Mao's Last Revolution. It's a history of the Cultural Revolution. It's published by Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. It was published last August, so you can certainly find it in the bookstore. Professor McFarker, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Also want to say thanks to Evan Whitney, the engineer there at Harvard on the other end of our connection, for making possible this high-quality hookup.